This is the Rise Up See Red podcast, all about the Arizona Cardinals and the NFL, featuring insider and outsider perspectives. Enjoy the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Now here are your hosts, Jess Root and Seth Cox.
Hello, Arizona Cardinals fans, and welcome to the latest edition of the Rise Up See Red podcast. This is your host, Jess Root from CardsWire.com. My co-host is Seth Cox from RevengeOfTheBirds.com. Yes, you'll notice that there's a new intro to the show, and we are on episode 194. So you get the insider and outsider perspectives. I have inside media access. Seth has some NFL sources, but both of us are Arizona Cardinals fans, kind of the fanalist with a little bit more. Seth, how are things going in the offseason as we are? We're just a couple of weeks away from regular shows again.
Yeah, it's almost back. It's almost time to actually talk about football again. And that's exciting. And I'm looking forward to the season. And man, it's really hot.
Yes, it is. Unfortunately, in some ways, we've got a lot of stuff to talk about. Unfortunately, the news that the Cardinals have been in have been non-football related. So this edition of the Rise Up See Red podcast, we are doing non-football Cardinals news, and we're ranking the NFC West. It's the show that we do once a year in kind of the dead of the off season. We are 2 weeks away. So in a programming sense, we're going to do the show this week. No show next week unless some other news happens. If David Johnson gets a new contract, something happens. But in 2 weeks, we will do the training camp preview because just around the corner is training camp. Then we'll take a week off for that. And from then on, we'll be doing a show every week pretty much from the first week of the preseason all the way till till the season is a couple of weeks gone. So episode 194, as I was joking around, hey, we're six episodes away from cable TV being able to show our podcasts on reruns, but that's not a real thing for us. But we could be eligible for syndication in six episodes.
That's right. We're knocking on the door.
Anyway, this show is about Steve Keim, Michael Bidwell, and then ranking the NFC West. We're going to start off with a story about Steve Keim. Not so great news over the holiday weekend. Steve Keim, Arizona Cardinals general manager, was charged with suspicion of DUI on the night of July 4th. It was technically very, very early on July 5th. And so Saturday morning, we wake up, it's a couple days after the holiday, and boom, a DUI for the general manager. What was your reaction to start off?
I mean, I'm one of those people that's pretty level-headed in these situations. I want to get as many facts as possible before I kind of jump in to the situation. But as somebody that spent quite a bit of time in Chicago and drinking in Chicago the last year while I was in school doing my clinical internship and things of that nature, hanging out with, you know, Justin Higdon and, you know, piling around town. The fact that I, as a broke intern student, could afford to pay for Ubers everywhere I went, and Steve Keim, an NFL GM, didn't pay for an Uber. That's always my biggest takeaway. It's like, why even put yourself in this situation? Like, you're a millionaire. Even if the cost of the Uber was $400, like, you're looking at thousands and thousands of dollars at this point. And you know, it was unfortunate that it came out. It's unfortunate that he made that decision. And you just hope kind of moving forward that if it's an actual problem, he gets the help he needs. If it was just a bad decision, that it's a one-time thing and he kind of learned his lesson.
When I heard the news, I was like, oh my gosh. This was different because the Cardinals have had, I mean, it's not a rash of problems, I would say, but it's happened. So we got Steve Keim, but the team had a statement immediately. Steve Keim had a statement immediately. Things were handled very quickly. And now, yes, we still have to wait and see if he was actually over the legal limit. But Keim came out and said he made a mistake. So obviously he admits that he did drive impaired and he's embarrassed for the mistake. And, you know, he's taking steps to fix things. And that's the thing that's different about this situation. I know there are a lot of fans who have already said, oh, it's guess what? One. Now, let's see if there's some racism here because they cut Michael Floyd's rear. And if there's a double standard when it comes to race, when it comes to player and executive. Interesting to think about that. There's a little bit different things here. If we go back over the last 4 years, Cardinals do have a track record of being, you know, supportive. We go back to 2014 when John Abraham got his DUI in Atlanta and then missed the start of training camp. He was in rehab. Cardinals didn't suspend it. He played that first game and ended up getting hurt, but there was no discipline for him. Bobby Massey, 2015, got nabbed with the DUI. Weird story, but the team didn't penalize him, but the league did suspend it for 2 games. He came back from a suspension, jumped right back into the starting lineup, and away they went. The difference was Michael Floyd in 2016. And when he was caught, I mean, that was a really bad one. He was way drunk. They ended up cutting him. But if you look at this, Michael Bidwell, team president afterwards, the decision came for him to cut. And that was not because of what happened with the DUI. It was what happened after the DUI. The fact that he didn't report it to the team. They had already heard about it. It took an hour and a half after that for Floyd to contact them. After it happened, the story changed. He never owned up to the problem. Bidwell actually, if you read between the lines, suggested that drinking probably was an issue, at least over the last year. And he was neither willing to take responsibility for it or do anything to fix things.
Yeah, fix
things. And on top of that, there was just a couple weeks left in the season. So they said, okay, there's no point to keep him. So they cut him. So, but it wasn't about the DUI itself. And this is a guy who had had multiple DUIs they knew about. And when they drafted him, because he'd had that issue at Notre Dame. And so Steve Keim, is this a fireable offense in your opinion?
Well, it comes back to information. We don't know of any previous issues with Keim. So that's a big deal to me. I'm not big on, you know, first offenses equal last offenses, unless it's something that kind of, you know, deserves that. But when you look at it from the perspective of it was the first time, again, that we know of that this has happened, that, he was upfront with his team, with his, you know, the people that are paying him, and they aren't seemingly irritated by it, or they seemingly aren't concerned by it. That's not to say that he's out of the weeds and in the clear, and you know, everything's hunky dory. It's not saying that at all. That's just the reaction to it from my end is that, okay, it was a mistake. Like, let's move on. Let's, you know, let's press forward and let's get back to football. And I think that's the right reaction to have and the right way to go about it for this organization.
There are a few things we did learn on Tuesday because the police report was released. Thanks to the work by EZCentral.com, Arizona Republic, they got a copy of that and they learned a little bit more. It makes things, and these are more of the details because I don't think Keim's in any danger to be fired, especially with a guy who just was signed to a contract extension. The things that he's done with the team, the relationship he has with the team president, the way he immediately stepped forward and express remorse and embarrassment, said he's doing things to fix things. So I don't think it's a fireable offense after one case because, I think that there's better ways to handle that, especially if it is a problem. You don't want to just kick a guy off to the curb. You would rather treat it like a problem if it's a problem. But I think the details that came out will be more telling as to how the league handles it, because the league and the players, we know that there's a system in place. If they get nabbed for DUI, they get 2 games. That's pretty much standard procedure these days. That's collectively bargained, but with the executive is different. But we learned a few things about Steve Keim's arrest, and the police reports are always interesting to run across. Now, this part wasn't in there, but according to azcentral.com, this is not Keim's, in fact, first DUI. There was another one that he had, although it was 22 years ago. So it was in 1996. I don't know if that qualifies as a problem, but that was almost a lifetime ago. I mean, 22 years ago, I was barely in college. So that's forever ago. We learned that he misrepresented himself, which is something that doesn't look good. He did identify himself as working for the Cardinals, that he was Steve Keim, but said he was director of security. I'm not sure what the whole purpose was that. And, you know, tried to bridge some sort of connection with an officer who's actually who actually died off duty a few years ago. It wasn't a case of where he declined to do any sobriety tests except for the light test. But I don't read into that at all. I'll tell you, I will not read into that. The report said he failed the light test, where you have to follow the light with your eyes. That's not good. He smelled of booze. He had bloodshot, watery eyes, slurred speech, but he declined any of the field sobriety tests of walking, citing his knee injury, which is true. He did have a knee injury in college. This is what ended his football career. But if you know anybody related to how you should handle that in terms of a legal perspective, almost any lawyer would advise you not to take any field sobriety. Don't take the breath test. Don't take the field test. Let them process you and insist in it. You can't decline. They can compel you to take the blood test. That's about the only thing. But you don't do those other things until that, for, you know, just in case that what comes out there is more damning than the blood test. So he was driving. It was kind of a weird situation. It's on a holiday where it's usually spent with family. He was out driving alone in the middle of the night. So these are all weird things. That's the thing. It's just all weird things. And hopefully this is the end of it. There's going to be a leak. I mean, we'll find out in a couple of months what the blood alcohol is. We'll probably see a TMZ. TMZ will probably come out with the camera evidence to see how it was. But other than that, I'm hoping that we can just, you know, turn the page until new news comes out, and then this is never an issue again. He gets fined and suspended for a few games at some point later this season or at the beginning of next, and we can close the book on it.
Well, and it's one of those situations where I can only imagine that the fine or, you know, the penalty contributed to the team or attributed to the team. I mean, it's got to be like a personal fine towards Keim. I can't imagine that they'll behold in the team responsible for this, like where they would have to forfeit picks or something.
I don't think so. I mean, I don't imagine that. Fireball fence, I think that would be ridiculous to do right now. Look at the amount of chance they gave Darryl Washington before they finally let him go. And they didn't. The reason why they let him go wasn't about, it wasn't even about anything other than the fact that he wasn't willing to take a pay cut at that point when he was nearly 30 years old. So even Darryl Washington, you look at everything that's happened and you just look at Darryl Washington. They worked through that absurdity. And even after he was reinstated, went back to the negotiating table with him. Like they were willing to have him back on the team under certain circumstances.
Yeah.
So enough of that. So coming next on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, we're going to talk about another not so fun story to talk about. But I mean, it's interesting, but for some, it might not be so fun. That's coming up next on Rise Up Sea Red, because we're talking about Michael Bidwill, Supreme Court, and politics and football again. That's coming up next on Rise Up Sea Red. As a reminder, our friends over at Harry's are continuing to support the show. Harry's, the shave club, if you want to call it that, that I made the switch to many months ago and love it. I'm still using the Harry's blades. I'm still shaving with that. Love it. I've given up on my electric blade razor. I don't know why I used it for so long. Actually, I do know why, because I didn't want to pay the price for the expensive blades, and the disposable blades just wasn't good enough. So I found the perfect match in between the two. So I've got a perfectly close shave with high quality blades at a fantastic price. Harry stands behind the quality of their blades, and they know that switching razors isn't always easy. So there's a trial offer that you guys, that our listeners can get by going to harrys.com/cred. They sell them directly to you through the internet. They can offer their blades at a price much lower than the leading brand. So when you get those per blade, they're only about $2 per blade. And the leading cost of other blades can cost twice that. And if you don't love your shape, let them know in 30 days and they'll give you a full refund. But right now, you don't even have to pay anything up front. So you get a $13 value trial set that comes with everything you need. You'll get the ergonomic handle. You'll get the 5-blade razor. It comes with the rich lathering shave gel. By the way, the shave gel is fantastic. Smells great. Works well. I love it. And, you know, you guys can claim it. So listeners of my show can redeem the trial at harrys.com/cred. Make sure you go there to redeem your offer and let them know I sent you to help support the show. Make sure to go to harrys.com/cred and take advantage of that trial offer. If you're like me, you'll love it and you won't go back, and you'll keep going with it because it's great shave at a great price. We're back on the Rise Up C-Red podcast. And well, we wrapped up with some not so great news, some DUI news, non-football news. We've got some more non-football news, and this came out on Monday. And that is where sports and politics sort of intervene. It's a cool story, but one that has taken, that has gotten a lot of criticism nationally from national media outlets, fans across the board about this story. And that is, you know, the President Trump, who has nominated Brett Kavanaugh for the Supreme Court, he's the Supreme Court nominee. Michael Bidwell, president of the Cardinals, knows him personally. They were part of the same graduating class at Georgetown Prep, and they've known each other for nearly 40 years. They're friends. And it came out, Adam Schefter shared this letter as the news of the nomination became public. Bidwell went to, I think it was 150, he was kind of the organizing, the one who mobilized everything, 150 of Kavanaugh's classmates from Jesuit Prep it's called Georgetown Prep, in a Jesuit high school in Washington, D.C. And they penned a letter of support for Judge Kavanaugh, as they can attest to his character, to his background, to his qualifications. And it's a group of 150 people that cross race, that cross class, that cross political spectrum. It really was a thing. Now, here's the rub. Darren Urban for azcardinals.com wrote a story on it. And, you know, the headline is, you know, Bidwell backs former classmate for Supreme Court. It's shared on social media, and that started an uproar. Oh, it's a double standard. Players can't talk politics, but owners can. Players, they say, Michael Bidwell himself was quoted in the new anthem policy. Hey, we can get back to football and not politics. And so people are upset, saying that basically the Cardinals are using their social media account and their team site to back a political candidate, a Supreme Court nominee. And, you know, right or wrong, it does raise some questions. What's your take on all of this, Seth?
I was shocked that it became this big to-do that it was. And so it was, you know, I kind of side with what you said. Like, if the team compelled, or sorry, if Bidwell compelled the team to write about it, you know, that's not correct. But from a news perspective, that's part of Darren Urban's job, is to write about what's going on around the team. And so I think, you know, it was a guy doing his job.
And the outrage. I mean, there's fan outrage. There's from both sides of the political spectrum. They're supporting him. They're saying this. Even media people of the media, Mike Florio, Pro Football Talk, Jamel Hill from ESPN, Jason Luckenfor retweeted Jeff Schwartz, former NFL player. People are saying, well, this is exactly what Colin Kaepernick is blackballed for. Now, I personally, I have nothing against the acts of either. I believe that Colin Kaepernick had the right to do what he did. I believe that Michael Bidwell has the right to do what he did. And I can see from, both of us write about the Cardinals. And so when we see Adam Schefter, and perhaps Darren was prepped a little bit because, hey, this letter that President Bidwell wrote is going to hit the media. So we want to have a story on it. It's national news that hits locally about the team president. But if you notice, if you read the story, it's about Bidwell knowing this guy and can vouch for his character and qualifications. There's nothing spoken politically about his judicial record, about what his political leanings are. Now, the part that we know that Michael Bidwell is in the political strength leans for conservative side. He's a supporter of Governor Doug Ducey. And so that automatically looks, in the word that we like to use these days, optics. The optics aren't great. And so I see the value of a story. And if this was a case, Darren sees the story come from Schefter, he's got to write about it. At the same time, I can get why people would question at the surface and think, oh, the team is supporting this Supreme Court nominee in a time where the NFL doesn't want to get into politics. But if you read it and you read the letter, it really isn't about politics. And the whole idea of a letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee to support this nominee, that's commonplace. People do that. And if you read the letter, it just tells you how impressive he is as in terms of qualifications, which you're going to run across every single nominee. They're all highly qualified. The things that he's done in his career, they can vouch for him personally and professionally, which is all that's about.
And it's just one of those situations where you look at it and it's continually, it's going to create issue. And I told you this off the air. This is, and I'm not one of those, like, I would never tell somebody, oh, stick to sports. Like I don't care about that. But when I think to myself, stick to sports, it's that's why I hate the intersection of politics and sports, because nothing ever like positive comes out of it. I mean, that's just the reality of it. And so like somebody's always going to be upset about it and, have their feelings hurt and get upset. And that's why, I mean, I don't typically write about it. I don't do, I don't cover it a lot, but this is a big story and one that, had to be discussed. And one of the reasons why is because of the way that the media, like you said, the media and the fan base reacted to it.
And, and this is the part that's hard for me is when sports and politics collide, that's where I'm far less of an expert about anything, because I've written about the Cardinals for a long time. I feel really comfortable in the things that I see and the insight that I have. When it comes to politics, you don't convince really anyone of anything. And so unless it's a case of just human decency, and this is not a case of human decency. This is about, hey, the Cardinals team president knows a Supreme Court nominee. And if you actually, what's super impressive, and this is a side note, if you look at the list of people who attended that prep school in Washington, D.C., they have had some power players in sports, in politics, and in in the business sector in general, because, you know, Brian Cashman, the GM for the New York Yankees, is went to that high school as well. Michael Bidwill, you know, you've got the Supreme Court nominee. It's really kind of ridiculous just how high profile that high school ended up being in the 80s.
Right. And you know, it was like what I think it was Adam Schefter wrote about with the Lake Falls in Texas, you know, Drew Brees and Nick Foles both graduating from there. It's crazy to see the alumni that have come from that location and how successful they all are.
Now, anything else we're talking about when it comes to Bidwill and politics and the Supreme Court? I think it's cool. I know personally, I think it's cool that they know each other. And I think it's cool that he knows him well enough to make that. Now, whether it's cool that that ends up being on the
team page,
I don't know. I understand why people would question that. The NFL right now in politics is really, really, really dicey, especially with the whole anthem thing, players kneeling, players trying to fight for injustice, and seemingly the owners wanting to shut them up. That's how it looks. There is that the league on the whole would rather just get rid of this, but then you get a team talking about this other thing. But is it really? And my question is this really any different of having that story on the team page as Colin Kaepernick, who basically started all the politics and football issue with his kneeling during the anthem? When NFL.com, when Steve Wyche wrote the story on NFL.com, which gave Colin Kaepernick's reasoning. And if you look at that, how different is it to have a reporter talk to the guy with a political stance, share his views on the NFL page? How different is that than to have Darren Urban talk to the team president and share why he wrote that letter? And it even didn't even talk about politics other than the fact that he believes that Judge Kavanaugh is qualified for the job. Or even, is it any different than Larry Fitzgerald talking about his admiration for Senator John McCain here in Arizona? Is there any difference that you see in those stories, like on the team page on NFL.com, as this one?
No, I mean, it's just covering news as it is, you know, as it is occurring. And so, you know, it just happens that some of the news is a cross section of things outside of sports. And so that's what happens every once in a while. And, you know, and that's the other thing that I would say about this whole thing is everybody has a decision if they want to consume that portion of the media, right? So, like, I don't have to click on any story about Michael Bidwill and Brett Kavanaugh. Like, I don't have to. It's actually quite easy. and in the same way, like, I didn't have to click on any story about Colin Kaepernick or things like that. So I think a lot of it just comes down to, like, sometimes you can not, you know, like if articles are written on team pages or NFL.com or anything like that, like one way to kind of avoid being upset about it is just not clicking on it.
And with that, yeah, I guess that's the case. I didn't see any problem with how the story was written or even what the story was written about. And it might be annoying, but people can be upset about it as well. I wish personally that people read the content of the letter and read the content of the story before they cry hypocrisy. It might be hypocritical in today's NFL to write a story like that. It might be. It is fair to question that. But please read the content of it before you get upset. That's you know, otherwise, look, Seth and I write all the time. If you're going to read is the headline, I guess that's all we can. I guess that's all we need to do. Write a headline, compose a tweet, and then you can form your opinion. Bam, that's it. Right?
Exactly.
That would make our jobs way easier. And with that, we'll wrap that part up. And coming up next on the Rise Up C-Red podcast, again, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. We're going to come back and we're talking about the NFC West and rank what we think the player, the best of the division, where do the teams sit at different positions? And that's coming up next on Rise Up C-Red. We're back on the Rise Up C-Red podcast for the next segment. Again, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. And we've got the NFC. This is our show where we rank the NFC West. I've started doing this on my site, cardswire.com. There's some nice debate going on, people talking about it, reading about it. But let's at least start on the offensive side of the ball. I think across the board, if we're looking at the teams on the whole, I think number one, we can say that the LA Rams appear to be head and shoulders above everyone else in the division. Would you agree with me on that?
Yes.
After that, there's a little bit of disagreement across the NFL. Some people say that the Cardinals are going to be bad, the Seattle's going to be down, and that San Francisco is trending upward. I see Seattle, Arizona, and San Francisco kind of all in the same boat. They, whether they're in a transitional year, a downslide or a downside, or in an uptick, I think they're all three outside of the Rams, who seem to have everything put together. There are lots of questions for the rest of the division, which makes this part fun. So let's start with the quarterbacks. So in some of these, we're going to do individually. So kind of what I've done on my site is in some positions, I've said, okay, who are the top? How do the quarterbacks stack up? Now, let's look at the quarterback situation. And if we look at quarterbacks, would you agree Russell Wilson clearly is the number one quarterback in the division?
I don't think that would be a question. I mean, I would be shocked if
– he's a superstar, right? Right?
I would be shocked if anybody didn't think he was, I guess, is the best way to look at it.
And with that, would it make sense to say that Jared Goff at this point is probably number two in the division? That clearly it's Russell Wilson number one and Jared Goff number two.
You could talk me into Jimmy Garoppolo as two right now, but I would say Goff is a fair number two right now.
Now, this is where this gets interesting. So we've got Sam Bradford, who performance-wise, he's good. He is an above-average quarterback. And we've got Jimmy Garoppolo, who has 7 career starts, but he won the last one. He's won, what is he, 7-0? 6-1?
He's won them all.
He's never lost a game in the NFL, but his numbers are a little bit above pedestrian. I mean, they're rather Sam Bradford-like, only he turns the ball over a little bit more. Who do you put ahead of whom? Do you say Bradford, Garoppolo, or do you say Garoppolo, Bradford, in your opinion?
I would probably say Garoppolo at this point, just because of the fact that the only reason Garoppolo hasn't played more is because that guy in New England that's in front of him. Whereas the only reason Bradford hasn't played more is because he's not able to get on the field 16 games a year. And so, you know, a favorite quote of ours on this here podcast is availability is a prospect's most important, ability. And one thing that Jimmy Garoppolo thus far in his career has shined with is being available to play. And you cannot say the same for Mr. Bradford. So hopefully that changes this year. I mean,
For me, obviously Bradford is the least, but I'm going to say this, what happened after two starts 2 years ago for Garoppolo? He got hurt. So in a small sample size, he also has had injury. Personally, I rank Bradford ahead of Garoppolo. I understand the availability part, but if I'm talking about who is the best quarterback, I said Russell Wilson, I say Jared Goff. I still think that Sam Bradford is a better quarterback than Jimmy Garoppolo is, at least right now. Bradford's never had a bad year. That's the thing. Bradford's never had a bad year. He's always been productive. The only knock is that he gets hurt. Garoppolo, he's won 7 starts. He went 5-0 down the stretch with the 49ers, but if you look at those 5 games, he threw 5 interceptions, and he only threw 7 touchdown passes. His passer rating was a very respectable 94.6, I think it is, something in the mid-90s. but he was not, as a quarterback, overwhelming by any means. He wasn't taking big chances. They were making easy throws, and they didn't score. They did not convert many touchdowns. Now, you could say the same type of thing about Sam Bradford, except for Sam Bradford takes better care of the football. I'm going to say Sam Bradford is better than Garoppolo right now. And then in a year, I'm just going to say that Josh Rosen is the best quarterback in the NFL, and is there's no one better, and we're seeing the beginning of the next Tom Brady. But that's just a completely Homer story for next year, right?
Exactly. That's we're going to have Josh Rosen as the top quarterback in this division. I've no doubt in my mind.
I mean, honestly, if he plays this year and shows off, you know, he's got a lot of potential. But I mean, honestly.
Well, and here's the craziest thing, and I know we're kind of joking around, but here's the craziest thing. Think about this: if Rosen plays, let's just say, 8 games or more, and plays well, and then Goff and Garoppolo both are healthy for the entire year and play. If we can even come back and say that Rosen is the third best at this time after a rookie season, that would be a huge coup. Would it not?
That would be fantastic.
I mean, so that's the thing is, yeah, I mean, yeah, we're kind of joking around, but think about it. Like if the guy can get on the field and perform and make it a conversation where you're saying, I don't know, is Jared Goff, is Jimmy Garoppolo really better? That would be huge for the Cardinals.
Which brings me to the next point, and this is now, how do we rank, not the quarterbacks, but how do we rank the teams in terms of their quarterback situation? I think across the board, we can say every single team in the NFC West is set up for the future. Russell Wilson, he's still in the prime of his career. He's not going anywhere. So they've got him long term. Jared Goff, he looks like a franchise quarterback. Josh Rosen looks like has all the makings that he was drafted to be the quarterback of the future. We still have to see it. Jimmy Garoppolo signed to a big, big contract. He's their quarterback of the future. So let's look at this year. Let's look at the way the quarterback rooms are stacked. How are they set for this year and like for the future? They're all set for the future. Who do you think has the best quarterback situation in the division?
That's a tough question because, one, I quite frankly can't even name the backup quarterback in Seattle at this point.
I'll do it. You've got Sam Bradford, Mike Glennon, and Josh Rosen. In Seattle, you got Russell Wilson and Austin Davis. In Los Angeles, you've got Jared Goff and Sean Mannion. In San Francisco, you've got Jimmy Garoppolo and C.J. Beathard.
Oh, that's right. I didn't know Austin Davis went up to Seattle.
He did.
Yeah. So when you look at it from that perspective, I mean, it sounds homerish, but I think the Cardinals have the best quarterback room in the sense that they have two guys with starting experience. Bradford is a known, you know, probably, like I've said before, top 15 quarterback in the NFL. He's right around the league average, if not slightly better than when he's on the field and playing. Glennon is a obviously replacement level starter, but a starter nonetheless. And so it comes down to then, of course, the one and only Josh Rosen, whereas every other team has a better, in my opinion, a better number one at this juncture, but none of them have a number two that would even compare to Glennon, little alone Josh Rosen.
Exactly. And then, you know, I agree, Seth, you are right because you agree with me. The Cardinals have the best quarterback situation, the entire quarterback situation, the best quarterback room of the division. They have three guys who are starter worthy this year, because if in pretty much any other situation, Josh Rosen is going to be the starter this year. The way he's done in the offseason, he would be the starter. But they've got a Sam Bradford who is a proven, solid starting quarterback, productive starting quarterback. You've got Mike Glennon, who is by far the best backup of that group. Now, Austin Davis has had success. Sean Mannion, what has he done? CJ Beathard has managed to lose a bunch of games. So I agree. You're right. Arizona's at the top. Who's your number two? Who's your number two in the division at the quarterback position overall?
Because all of the backups are so uninspiring, I think from there it would just go in order of starter. Because you can't, like, honestly, if you took Austin Davis, Sean Mannion, and CJ Beathard and just swap them from every team, would you feel better about anybody's situation? And my answer would be no. Beathard looked god awful in his short time.
What does Sean Mannion even look like?
Right. Mannion's, I don't even think, has gotten on the field. And then Austin Davis has been replaced multiple times in multiple locations.
And at least this, in 2014, he was a serviceable quarterback for the Rams as a starter in 2014.
So, you know, from there, I think, I would think it's Seattle. And then the coin flip really becomes the 3-4 spot, because, like you said, we don't know anything about Sean Mannion. I mean, literally nothing. So is it fair to say, well, Goff is a better quarterback right now than Garoppolo, but how do you rank the backups when you haven't seen one?
And that's where I still have, I mean, which would I rather know? Why, I do you rather have a Sean Mannion, who obviously the Rams trust enough to be the backup, or CJ Beathard, who you've seen on the field and is really kind of bad? Right. I'll take Mannion. I'll take the unknown in Mannion this time. Because so. Neither is a devil I really know. So I'll take the unknown, and plus the fact that I believe that Jared Goff is a superior quarterback to Jimmy Garoppolo at this point. So the quarterback situation, they've got a better starter, and the backup's an unknown. Garoppolo, who I think is the fourth best starter in the division already, and then you give him the potentially the worst backup of the group. So they're all set for the future. But I think the Cardinals are really the only team, if they're going to be competitive at all, they're the only team that could survive with their backup quarterback. You put Austin Davis in that Seattle team, it's a disaster. You put Sean Mannion for the Rams, it's a disaster. We saw what the 49ers looked like with CJ Beathard. They were terrible. So I think the quarterback, at least the situation right now, the Cardinals are in the most stable situation across the board.
I agree. And I wouldn't, you know, obviously, if you gave me the choice, and it's because Rosen hasn't played yet, but if you gave me the choice, I'd prefer, you know, Seattle's situation because of Russell Wilson, because he's still young, because he is, you know, he's getting to the point where we're talking about a Hall of Fame level transcendent player. So, you know, that's different. I wouldn't switch quarterback rooms with either Los Angeles or San Francisco. And I think that says quite a bit when, you know, in January, when we were having these conversations, that was not what we were thinking at all.
No, because we had no quarterback at all. Running back. Let's talk at the bottom. If we're talking individuals. So if you've got four projected starting running backs, you've got Todd Gurley, David Johnson, Jerick McKinnon now for the San Francisco 49ers, although whether he's the clear starter or if he's the 1A and Matt Breida 1B, and then what it appears it will be first-round pick Rashad Penny will be the guy in Seattle. It appears to be. I think we know who our 1-2 is going to be, and we're going to talk about them. But in between 3-4, who do you put in third and fourth? Do you do McKinnon Penny or Penny McKinnon?
I like Rashard Penny quite a bit. I think he's going to be a very good running back in the NFL. But in the same way that if Josh Rosen was the unquestioned starter for the Arizona Cardinals, I would rank him as the fourth starter for the NFC West at this juncture. I am saying the same for Penny. He projecting in the NFL is hard, and projecting on a team with an awful offensive line for a rookie running back is even more difficult.
And that's the way I have it as well. I have, because Penny is still unproven, I have him behind McKinnon, who is at least somewhat proven. Not impressive, but somewhat proven. And what's interesting is if you look at the starting running backs across the board, you look at Gurley, David Johnson, McKinnon, and Penny, all three are dual threats. All of them can catch the football and run. All of them can run. And actually, with the exception of Gurley, three of them could be and have been dynamic returners.
And that's the whole thing with this, where we're at right now in the NFL, right? Like, we're going back to kind of not necessarily workhorse running backs, as in, you know, running the ball 380, 400 times in a season. But moreover, we're going back to running backs who can be on the field for all three downs because they need to be able to do both.
So, 1-2, that's the other debate. Who do you have as your number one? Do you take Todd Gurley and what he did in 2017? Or do you take David Johnson and what he did in 2016?
So, the only reason I would take Todd Gurley over David Johnson, and there's not many reasons, and there's actually only one, and it's because of age. But if you're going into a single season and you're just saying, like, look, how would you rank this for 2018? That's a more difficult concept and question. But again, I tend to favor the player that has done it most recently.
Yes.
Not saying that David Johnson cannot or will not, but saying that instead I want to see him come back healthy and produce again.
And that's where I'm at with David Johnson. I have them ranked the same way individually. Gurley just over Johnson. Basically, they're tied. Basically, it's 1A, 1B. But it comes down to me, it's two things. Recency and continuity. We saw Todd Gurley do it last year. He had a David Johnson-like season. He was offensive player of the year. And he's in the same offensive system, again, that he did it a year ago. David Johnson should have been offensive player of the year, in my opinion, in 2016. But he's coming off he's missed a year, and he's in a new scheme. So what we will see from him in the new offensive scheme is an unknown. I expect great things out of David Johnson once he gets the contract signed. But Todd Gurley is still my number one because of recency and continuity there. But let's talk about the running back rooms. Now, do we change the order at all? I don't change anything with San Francisco and Seattle. Matt Breda is a nice backup. So if I have McKinnon ahead of Penny, then I'm definitely going to have McKinnon and Breda ahead of Penny and whoever ends up being the backup running back in Seattle. The question is, do we rank Arizona with with David Johnson and potentially Chase Edmonds or TJ Logan ahead of the Rams and their depth chart, where it projects that right now that it'll be Todd Gurley and then who is it? Malcolm Brown. Yeah. Whose overall running back room do you like better? I put the Cardinals slightly ahead, and I think it's being a little homerish, but I think their versatility, because of the type of player that Chase Edmonds looked like he will be, and the speed of TJ Logan, and potentially if DJ Foster can be like, I think that's a better, if David Johnson and Todd Gurley basically equals, I like the Cardinals backups better than their options in Los Angeles.
It's a difficult one because, like you kind of said, the top running backs are so far ahead of the backups in these cases that when you have a Malcolm Brown as your number two, you're going, eh. And so, you know, it comes down to Brown has at least performed in the NFL. I'm not going to say he's performed well, but he's got 63 carries in the NFL, averaged just under 4 yards a carry on those 63 carries. TJ Logan and Chase Edmonds have a combined 0 carries. And so, again, just out of trying to stay consistent, I would say I would rank the Rams higher, only because Brown hasn't been asked to do much, but when he has, I mean, last season, for instance, he carried the ball 63 times. He had 250 yards, 4 yards a carry, you know, 9 catches on 11 targets. I mean, the guy's not used at all. He had 72 touches on the season. You know, he's not used at all.
Probably some of the touches he's going to get this year, to be honest. Todd Gurley, they get all the touches. He just has to go in to be in a play or two a game.
Exactly, and it's the same. And I'm assuming it'll be similar to the Cardinals. I mean, you know, they brought in Chase Edmonds to be a backup and to David Johnson. They didn't, you know, bring in Chase Edmonds to spell David Johnson. So... but so for that reason alone, I would just put the Rams at the top, but you could, you know, convince me another way.
At wide receiver, let's look at the rooms overall. Interesting. I put the Cardinals dead last because, well, in my opinion, I still think Larry Fitzgerald is the best receiver in the division, but they have an uninspiring group behind him with, you know, second round pick Christian Kirk. Interesting. J.J. Nelson and his inconsistencies, Chad Williams and his 3 catches as a rookie, or Bryce Butler and his hasn't had more than 400 yards in a season since high school. Unimpressive to me. So that's the bottom. Who do you put at the top? Who do you think is the best wide receiver?
That's the hard part because I would say it's the Rams at this juncture just because – Cooks is a, you know, a legitimate 1,000-yard dude.
He's a dynamic player and could be more productive. Questionable character, apparently. This is on his third team in 3 years. Right. But, yes.
And so then I would say Robert Woods is an unquestioned standout number two receiver in the NFL. And then Cooper Kupp showed his salt last year. So their top three are invaluably better than anybody else's top three, but I wouldn't say that their one would be better than anybody else's one. And so I would have the Rams at one.
That is the same argument I use. At number two, I have Seattle, and it's not by much. Doug Baldwin, he had a down. I mean, statistically, he had a down year a little bit, a couple of ticks down. He is a very good receiver, very tough to guard. People are going to criticize me for this. The addition of Brandon Marshall, I think, is a great addition, assuming he comes back from that ankle injury. He was a 1,500-yard receiver 3 years ago, led the league in touchdowns. His size and his catching ability, he could be, as a target for Russell Wilson on those busted plays, he's going to be very hard. In fact, Doug Baldwin and Brandon Marshall might be the two hardest receivers in the division to guard just because they're so physical and they're so unrelentless. So I put Seattle at number two, Tyler Lockett. He's a solid number three. So they are my number two. What do you have them at number two as well, or do you have San Francisco?
No, I would have them at two because I'm still a big Tyler Lockett believer. And so that's why I would have them there. Because here's the thing, right? Like, so if you put everybody's number ones at the top, I'm probably going to take Arizona, but that's because I'm a homer.
And Fitz is still amazing. I mean, how can you say no to that? He's probably, in my opinion, he's a top seven receiver in the game. Even though Brandon Cooks adds something, I still think Fitz is better. Fitz is better than Cooks, in my opinion.
And so, but then there's a chasm between the Cardinals and then their number two. Whereas when you look at when you look at the Rams, like I said, you have Cooks, who's a good number one. You have Woods, who's a fantastic number two, and Kupp, who is basically a number two as well, and produced a number two level last year. In Seattle, you have a dynamic one in Doug Baldwin, and you have a guy that still can produce at a number two level in Tyler Lockett. So that's why I would have Seattle at two. Brandon Marshall does nothing for them or me on that team. I think Jerron Brown will end up having more of an impact than he will. And really, to me, the only debate is between three and four.
And so, well, San Francisco to me, yeah, they got Pierre Garçon, they got Marquise Goodwin, and they have Trent Taylor. Pierre Garçon played in 8 games last year, had 40 catches for 500 yards. He is a very productive receiver, but it probably is he's a serviceable number one, in my opinion. Better, he'd be a great number two. But when your number two is Marquise Goodwin, there's potential there. Trent Taylor, he's a productive but replaceable third receiver. But there, I mean, because they have three serviceable receivers and the Cardinals have one and then question marks, that's why I put them ahead of the Cardinals.
Well, and if Chad Williams had shown anything last year, I think you could put the Cardinals at three. But the fact that Trent Taylor's rookie year is better than Bryce Butler's best year in the NFL.
Stop it. Stop it. And people think that Bryce Butler is going to be the number two receiver.
Right. And so that's what the issue becomes. It's like one of our writers at Revenge of the Birds wrote today, like, who steps up as the number two wide receiver, and made a case for Chad Williams, and then had the poll at the bottom that said, you know, who's the number two wide receiver on the team. Now, Christian Kirk is winning, but as we've done in all of these rankings, it's really hard to pass a rookie off as being a guy that's going to make that impact in year one. But the staggering amount of people that voted for Bryce Butler to be the number two receiver in Arizona, and I'm like, have you not followed his career at all? Like, have you not watched what he's done at all? So
he wasn't dominating in college.
Right.
So potential, like, there is so much potential there, but he hasn't had a great year since high school.
Right. Exactly. So yeah, I would agree with you that San Francisco's three and Arizona's four simply because of the unknown factor. I mean, you're relying on a guy that's never had more than 350 yards in a NFL season to potentially be your number two. Obviously, you know, like we talked about, hopefully Chad Williams does something. Hopefully Christian Kirk is what everybody expects him to be. But I think, again, known production from the San Francisco trio outweighs potential production from the Arizona trio.
It's okay. Now give me your five. I'm going to give you my top five actual individuals in the division at receiver. My one is Fitz, my two is Cooks, my three is Baldwin. I put Brandon Marshall number four. I'm a bigger believer in Marshall than I think you are, and I put Pierre Garçon at five. Do you change anything outside of Fitz at the top?
So I have Fitz one. I would say Doug Baldwin is two. And then I would honestly go Cooks, Woods, and Kupp three, four, and five, which is why they're –
definitely the top receiver. They got three of the top five.
Right. Because I'm not a big believer in Garçon anymore. I mean, he's on the wrong side of 30. Same with Brandon Marshall. I mean, if they had stayed consistently healthy like Fitz has, it would be a little different for me, but that's just why I don't believe in them. And I still believe Tyler Lockett is probably number five, but the guy has to produce at some point. He was on his way before that, you know, obviously disgusting and unfortunate leg break. But so now you're just kind of waiting to see if he's back to full health in 2018 and can produce.
Let's look at the tight end. The tight end, when I did the rankings today for tight end, what an unremarkable group of tight ends there are in the division. Now that Jimmy Graham is gone, the tight end room for all the NFC West is pretty much meh. You know who is second in receptions among all the remaining tight ends in the NFC West? Jermaine Gresham, who Cardinals fans cannot wait to get rid of. They can't wait to get rid of him. And so, number one, I have – this is my tight end room. I go number one, San Francisco, and it's unremarkable because they've got George Kittle and Garrett Celek. Garrett Celek is a tight end that San Francisco fans want to replace so badly. George Kittle's led the of the group, had, I think it was 45 receptions, so he leads the division, the current division tight ends in receptions. So I think they've got the best overall room. I go number two, the Cardinals. Even though Gresham's coming back from an injury, I think there's a lot of upside with Ricky Seals-Jones, and I think it also has every much to do about just the rest of the division. The Rams, I have at three. They've got Tyler Higbee and Gerald Everett. Gerald Everett was supposed to be good. They were really excited about him. He produced 16 catches in 16 games, as opposed to Ricky Seals-Jones, who was an undrafted rookie. There was a three-game period where he produced 12 catches. Then I put Seattle at the back end, even though I think Nick Vinette has the most potential of the group to be good. He hasn't done it yet, as they've got Ed Dixon. He's a nice addition. But
Ed Dixon is an underrated signing by them because, like you said, Vinette is the clear, like, hope, full starter, but Dixon's one of those guys that'll go out and produce like 40 catches for, you know, 600 yards. Like that's just been kind of Ed Dixon's MO for his career, is like everybody's always trying to replace him, and all he does is continue to like find jobs and work. Not necessarily, I mean, he's not a guy that is going to blow the top off or anything, but you know, last year for Carolina at age 30, 30 catches for 437 yards. Like when this guy gets a chance to be the main guy, he produces. He never gets a chance because he's always
he's behind Greg Olsen.
He's behind Greg Olsen. And then in Baltimore, he was behind Dennis Pitta. And who was the other tight end that they drafted? I can't even remember his name, but so it's one of those situations. I tend to think that I agree with you. San Francisco's one. I tend to think that number two is LA because I think Higbee is probably on par with Gresham. And I'm, of course, talking about a Gresham on a bum Achilles Gresham. I'm not talking about, like, at full health Gresham. And then I think you have I think Everett is going to improve this year as a weapon. But they have a lot of weapons. Like, that's the one thing about the Rams is they've really revamped and rebuilt their entire offense. If Gresham was completely healthy, I would probably swap the Cardinals and Rams, but I just don't buy that he's going to be ready game one. I just don't buy it at all. That's an Achilles injury. It's not an ACL. So I think I would go San Francisco, LA, Arizona, and then I agree with you on Seattle, but again, it's not like it's a knock on Seattle. It's not like we're saying like, oh, Seattle's just terrible at that position. It's like
no one is good.
Right. Like, I do think Kittle has a chance to be a star. I do, because his size, speed is kind of,
and Garoppolo love throwing to him because
right.
He likes doing that.
I think that's going to be one to watch. But yeah, like you said, what an unremarkable group as a whole.
Hey, at least the Seahawks don't have Jimmy Graham anymore, right?
Right.
and if it were for Jimmy Graham, maybe Tyvon Branch would still be on the team or could have played. Offensive line. This is an interesting one because right now I still think the Rams are at the top because they – don't really change anything. They're going to have to replace Jermon Brown for a little bit, but they were a very good offensive line unit last year. The rest of the division was kind of a mess, but you look at what Seattle's done to add. I mean, Dwayne Brown, I like at left tackle. Kenny Britt returns. Justin Britt returns. they add, they have their at on the offensive line now. So you've got, who is that at right tackles? So they've got Ifedi, DJ Fluker coming in at guard. Not a bad thing. Postich is supposed to improve at left guard. I have Seattle, as bad as their offensive line was a year ago, I see them improve to second best in the division, in my opinion. Do you see it differently?
I mean, it's just, it's one of those situations where you're relying on rookies and health. And I hate doing that. But on the flip side, who's better?
Well, that's right. San Francisco, they've got Joe Staley. He's great. They locked up Lakin Tomlinson. He's solid.
Yeah, and Richburg's not bad.
Garnett hasn't been good yet.
Garnett may not make the team.
That's crazy. And he was such supposed to be this sure thing. But they added Mike McGlinchey, and that should be very good at right tackle, in my opinion.
Well, and they added Jonathan Cooper, so.
Oh, there you go.
But, yeah, I mean.
Championship.
Yeah, when you look at, I mean, Joe Staley's like Larry Fitzgerald, right? Like, it's just one of those situations where you kind of wait for him to tail off a little bit, and it just doesn't happen. So, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, you can't sell me on the Cardinals being ahead of them, but. It's just,
but they could be. That's the thing. I actually like what the Cardinals did with their offensive line. I just can't say they're better yet. I think they can be because DJ, when he plays, he's good. If Mike Iupati's healthy, I mean, this is an offensive line that's going to maul people in the running game if they're all healthy. I have that feeling. It's going to be very fun to see. If they stay healthy, this is a line. That's going to be good, I think.
And that's the hope, is that they stay healthy. And that's, you know, that's the biggest bugaboo of the – I mean, outside of Shipley, literally that's the question mark for all,
every
all of
– single one.
So – and then when you look at – when you look at Seattle, they've revamped their offensive line again. Dwayne Brown's obviously a very, very, very good player. I would say he's probably the third best left tackle in the division, and he's 32. I mean, the best left tackle is Andrew Whitworth, and he's, I think, 40. I mean, I think he's legitimately 36. You know, Staley's 33, Brown's 32. I mean, that's the left tackles, and this isn't a shot at DJ by any means. Those are three guys that are all pros. I mean, they're three really freaking good left tackles. You know, but the interior is a lot of questions, and Jermaine Ifedi has been kind of a dumpster fire so far for them. So, I mean, I would say it's probably LA. I mean, it's obviously LA, but then I think it would go San Francisco. Arizona and Seattle, you know, they both have a lot of question marks. I would say from a production standpoint, Arizona's better from a – well, all five guys play. Seattle's is probably better. So I'm going to go with production outside of – and just hope that they stay healthy.
And with that, we will come back for the final segment of the Rise Up C-Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web, and we will talk about the defensive side of the ball. That's coming up next on Rise Up C-Red. We're back on the Rise Up C-Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. We're going to talk defense now, and this is kind of interesting because, you know, as I look at the rankings defensively, I would think that the Rams would be more at the top on some of these. They actually are, I think, the worst team at a couple of positions, which might surprise me. Let's talk about the defensive line. My order goes Rams, Cardinals, 49ers, and Seahawks. Obviously, we're going to look at, we've got now the Rams run a 3-4, but they've got Ndamukong Suh and Aaron Donald, so that wins everything. I put the Cardinals second because now when you've got their edge, I think the Cardinals' edge players are the best edge players in the division. With Chandler Jones and Marcus Golden, with a healthy Marcus Golden, you've got the two best edge players in the division, in my opinion. Because Seattle lost Cliff Averill, they don't have Michael Bennett, and so they've got Frank Clark, who potentially could be really good, and they've got somebody else on the other end. I don't even remember the name of him. I can look him. that's how. So they've got on the other side, they've got Rasheem Green. Okay, he's not bad. Rasheem Green, Frank Clark, and then you've got Deion Jordan, who's got – there's – I've got the Cardinals at number two because I like their defensive interior. Robert Condici looks about ready to be good, and Corey Peters is good. So I go Rams one, Cardinals two, then I go San Francisco three because they've got some talent there with DeForest Buckner and Eric Armstead. Those are good players who – you just need to put it together. So you've got Eric Garner, so you've got Solomon Thomas, DeForest Buckner. Those are great players in the making. And Seattle, they're on the wrong side. That's a decline. That's a declining line that they've got based on what they've had from years past. When you go from Cliff Averill and Michael Bennett to now Frank Clark and Rasheem Green, you've got Jerron Reed in the middle. He's not bad. Nazir Jones, not bad. But I think that puts them at the back of the division on the defensive line, which is new.
And I would agree with that order. I wouldn't really change anything. I mean, you could talk me into San Francisco being ahead, but Solomon Thomas and Eric Armstead need to show more before I would put them in front of Arizona. When it comes to the linebacker position, I still think that Seattle takes the cake in the division, because when you have Bobby Wagner and KJ Wright still there, yes, that's a really tough combo to beat.
And for me, they're my number one. I put the Cardinals in, and I'm looking across the board on my rankings in the four position groups. The Cardinals are in the top two in all four of my position groups. Defensively, which says a lot. I've got, while Reuben Foster is a better individual linebacker, I like the trio of Dalen Buchanan, Josh Bynes, and Hassan Reddick better than I like the combo of Foster and Eli Harold and Malcolm Smith in Seattle. And the Rams, from their linebackers to me are outside of who's not even healthy yet, you've got Mark Barron. The rest of that group, and especially their edge players, that's uninspiring. You've got Matt Longacre, who's able, Samson Ebukam. They don't have their edge presence is not impressive. Bryce Hager and Mark Barron. That's not an imposing linebacker core to me.
No, it's not, and I would agree with that. If Reuben Foster wasn't in the league's doghouse already, I would think about putting the 49ers too. But you really don't know how much time Foster's going to get this year. He's got a number of issues off the field that are being taken care of. So when you look at it from that perspective, I think you're right. You got Seattle, Arizona, and then San Francisco, and then LA.
And cornerback, I think you. This is where, again, LA is dominant in the front when you've got Sue and Aaron Donald. They're also now dominant in cornerback when they got Marcus Peters and Aqib Talib, and then their nickel cornerback. What is it? What's his name?
Nickel Roby.
Yeah, Nickel Roby. Yeah. That's great. The division suddenly looks different. Patrick Peterson, Jamar Taylor, I think, is the second best pair. And while Richard Sherman, we've got to figure out if Richard Sherman's going to look good this year. But it's also because Richard Sherman's San Francisco's other cornerback is.
Akilah
Witherspoon. That's uninspiring. And Seattle, who was probably for the last seems forever, was number one at cornerback. They've got the worst two corners, in my opinion. Now, Shaquille Griffin, or He's promising. He's promising. But as of yet, I don't look at Griffin and Nico Thorpe as anything scary. Right. They don't intimidate any team. Patrick Peterson, no one throws at him. Jamar Taylor, he's a proven starter. Obviously, the Rams are a class above that because they have two shutdown corners on their defense. And then 49ers have a guy who can be a shutdown corner in Richard Sherman. But the Seahawks, they're kind of a mess back there now.
Well, especially with Cam Chancellor leaving or retiring or not playing or whatever you want to call it. Because, yeah, those are two inexperienced guys in Thorpe and Griffin. So when you look at this grouping, I look at it as I would take a healthy San Francisco, like a completely healthy San Francisco cornerback duo over the Cardinals in the new scheme of Steve Wilks. However, you're talking an Achilles. We have no idea how players, you know, react and respond to Achilles. So, you know, Richard Sherman could come back as a shell of himself. And Akilah Witherspoon, I think, is a nice player. I just, you know, if he's your corner one, I think you're in trouble. So I would say, obviously, it's L.A. Then it's the Cardinals because of Peterson. And then San Francisco and Seattle. But, you know, that's the thing is in Wilkes' new scheme, we'll see how Peterson responds to that.
At safety, this is where I have the Cardinals number one. This was not the case before now, but the departure of Cam Chancellor changes things. I believe the Cardinals at safety have the best duo between Buda Baker, who looks like he is on the verge of stardom, and Antoine Bethea, who is quite serviceable and very solid, a very good player. Seattle still has the best safety in Earl Thomas. But if they're going to play Mo Alexander or Akeem King, that's not inspiring at all.
Right. And I think as in terms of who's done it thus far, I would rank, like if we're just ranking individual safeties, I would say it's obviously Earl Thomas is in a class of himself, but I think Jaquiski Tartt from San Francisco is probably the second best in the division right now. However, Adrian Colbert doesn't really inspire much in terms of ability. You know, you kind of hit on it with Bethea. Like if you say your rankings just from an individual perspective again are Thomas, Tartt, and probably LaMarcus Joyner, and then Buda Baker, but then who's your next one? Well, it's Antoine Bethea. And so that's why you would say the Cardinals probably have the best duo because they're two are just as good as the ones from the other team. You know, and it's interesting, and you know, you can't have an all-star team at every level, but the Rams sure did try it. they didn't find linebackers or safeties, you know.
And I have the Rams last at safety. So I have them as good. So this is how their defense looks to me. Number one on the defensive line, number one at cornerback, but last in the division at linebacker and safety. But
we'll see if that even matters, though.
Right, because what we know about linebacker and safety, they're not premium positions, and you can get production out of decent players, right? And especially in a scheme that puts them in position, you can have guys produce.
Well, and if you have pass rushers, which they have, and if you have lockdown corners, which they have, all of a sudden everybody else gets better.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. That's why when you look at where, you know, Seattle's strength is now at the linebacker core, it's going to be interesting to see how that kind of folds into who they are as a team overall.
And I think, well, if you look at Seattle, for me, I think defensively they're gonna take a step back. But I think they did things offensively that will help them. If that offensive line pans out, I think they will put up points, which will make for a fun division.
Yeah, exactly. It should be a little different this year. I mean, when you look at it, all things considered, obviously on paper, LA's in a class by themselves. I don't think anybody's going to argue that it's really even close. But again, that's on paper.
And if we look at special teams, at punter, everyone's set. Because you got John Ryan, you got Andy Lee, you got Johnny Hecker, and you got Bradley Pinion. All those punters are good. At kicker, you've got Zuerlein is clearly the class. Robbie Gould has been very good. And then, I did not even realize this, Sebastian Janikowski in Seattle?
Yeah, I know.
So you've got question marks with Phil Dawson and Sebastian Janikowski simply because they are old. And Dawson had his struggles last year. The return games for both teams, solid. Dante Pettis for San Francisco, even as a rookie, he's got dynamic return skills. TJ Logan looked great if he can stay healthy. And Farrell Cooper's good. Tyler Lockett, he's scary. So I have pretty much everyone across the board pretty even, but this is the order. I go Rams, 49ers, Seahawks, Cardinals.
I would probably flip the last two because I don't trust Janikowski at all. But should
we trust Dawson at this point?
That's a very fair question.
And the coaches, I think this one's pretty easy. I still think Pete Carroll is the class of coaching. Sean McVay, after that, he could overtake Carroll.
I mean, we're within a year of it.
Yeah.
It being an actual conversation.
Kyle Shanahan? Well, he's actually coached, and now you've got Steve Wilks. I can't put Steve Wilks higher than fourth in this division because he hasn't done anything yet. And exactly. Shanahan did something. He improved them. Sean McVay won a division title, and Pete Carroll's won the Super Bowl. So
exactly,
and lost a Super Bowl. That was great.
Yeah, I wish the Cardinals had been to a Super Bowl with Bruce Arians. So yeah, you know, that's one of those things. And I think you're accurate. I mean, let's hope again next year we're talking about Josh Rosen and Steve Wilks as being some of the better, within the division.
That would be fantastic. Anything else the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web has become the best hour and a half. So we got a bonus 30 minutes. Anything else worth talking about?
Not tonight. I mean, I'm looking forward to the start of training camp and kind of real Cardinals talk.
And that with that, this is what ends the 194th episode of the Rise Up Sea Red podcast. We'll be back in 2 weeks to preview training camp. That's Seth Cox. I'm Jess Root. He's from RevengeOfTheBirds.com, and I'm from CardsWire.com. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
Thanks for listening to the latest edition of the Rise Up Sea Red podcast. Listen to previous episodes and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, Audioboom, or many other podcast platforms so shows are delivered directly to your mobile device. Please give the show a 5-star rating and always support the sponsors who support the show. We'll be back soon for the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Rise up, Red Sea, be Red Sea Red, and of course, Rise Up, Sea Red.
Yeah.